Mike, when you see an offense now built around
threes,
right, yeah. And spraying the floor.
That's fine with me.
Yeah. You're saying what to yourself watching that?
I'm going to get to the rim all day long. Like, oh, yeah, it's on. It is on right now.
Blips of audacity just going swimmingly because I'm here recording today on Almighty Ball and the Almighty Podcast with Doug Branson of Hive Talk Live. And now, what is he? Locked On Hornets. I am used to you guys. I subscribed to you guys before you were on the Locked On Network, so I'm actually used to you guys as Hive Talk Live. So that's just me, though.
Well, that's good. No, that's good. We love all of the fans who joined before and all of the fans who are joining now. Yeah, so we were Hive Talk Live. Actually, before that, we were Podcats. It started as Podcats because we began the podcast 4 seasons ago, if you can believe that, before there was any news about the Hornets' name returning. We were a Bobcats-only podcast.
Wow.
So it's nice to have some fans before we became Locked On. But yeah, now we're Locked On Hornets, presented by Hive Talk Live.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea that you guys were the Podcats before, but that's great. I've thought about having something that's like Pod Almighty, because, you know, like Pod Almighty.
I like it.
But, I mean, Podcats, that's really up there in terms of wordplay for podcast titles.
The problem with it was that there was already a Podcats. And they didn't talk about cats, and they weren't talking about sports. I don't really know what they were talking about, but they stole all of, they didn't steal, they were there first, but they had all of the search, all the searches went to them and not to us. So we would have had to change the name eventually anyhow. Luckily, the Hornets name came back, and we landed on Hive Talk Live.
Yeah, and I mean, the Hornets, I haven't talked to a lot of Charlotte fans who wouldn't rather root for the Hornets than the Bobcats anyways, just because, you know, there is that whole history thing behind the Hornets. There is that whole, I mean, also, whoever did the logo design did really well, I think. But Hugo looks menacing on y'all's logo.
Yeah, he's, so
it's a really good look.
They sort of went away when they did the redesign. They went away from the kind of cartoon Hugo that matched the mascot.
Yeah.
And it was, and here's a piece of trivia for you. The original mascot was created by Jim Henson's daughter.
Huh.
So there's some trivia for you. But yeah, the new Hugo mascot looks similar to the old Hugo mascot, but they definitely went for a more sort of modern, menacing logo, and we at the podcast, we like the redesign as well.
Yeah, and it's also, I feel like it gives that competitive edge. If I had to say one thing that differentiates this team from, you know, the Raymond Felton, Sean May, Bobcats of old, it's not talent, it's the logo. That's what it is. That's why they're better, right there.
Yeah, yeah. You listen, it all starts with the branding. That's, you know, Darren Ravel. I mean, it all, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's, everybody likes him, right? All right, anyway.
Well, speaking of branding, where can our listeners find you on Snapchat?
On Snapchat, well.
I'm just kidding. Twitter and Facebook.
You can find us on Snapchat. There's not much there until actual games get played.
Messing with you because
yeah. You're gonna get me off on this tangent already. See, Chris, it's tough for Snapchat because I'm sitting here in my studio and I don't know what to snap. I don't feel like anyone wants to see me sitting alone in my studio. So you know, when games start being played, we'll snap on Hive Talk Live. But yeah, Twitter at Hive Talk Live, Facebook.com/ Hive Talk Live. And here's an important one, Chris. We're going live on YouTube. That's right. It's 2016. We decided to get on the video bandwagon. We hear it's a hot thing. So YouTube, search Hive Talk Live and subscribe to our YouTube channel to watch us do the show live starting in October.
Yeah. I recorded yesterday I've been setting up a little studio thing here, and I had my first trial run of my video setup because we're going on video two. So, you know, if let me say, Doug, if I'm doing it, it means that it's a good idea. You know, I think I set the industry standard for excellence.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm in.
So anyways, Doug, as the listeners have figured out by now, we are talking today about the Charlotte Hornets. And there's a lot to talk about. I think I want to start with this idea. So the two podcasts that I'm recording today, one is about the Clippers after this, and then I'm talking about the Hornets right now. And both of these teams, I didn't set it up this way, but both of these teams seem like they have a objective to learn how to crawl before they walk, or walk before they run, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. I think it is important for struggling franchises or historically struggling franchises to take that first step before you really go full out, okay, let's, you know, Hinkify this and come out and get Ben Simmons and just really try to like kill the league and swing for the fences. I like what Michael Jordan's strategy is. I think it's realistic. I think, you know, yeah, you guys could absolutely win 50, 55 wins, but you're not going to win like 30 wins. You know, you're not going to just totally fall apart. And I think that's important just because, you know, it's a new franchise and, you know, you have to take that first step. So what do you think about that outside analysis? Do you think that that's maybe underselling what you guys are doing? Are you fully on the, okay, we're going to win a championship next year? So, yeah, just I want to hear what a fan's input is on my impression of how the Hornets are building.
Well, I think you could say walk or crawl before you walk, but I think you could also say continuity. There are a couple things going on here with the way that the Hornets are building now. First of all, the Bobcats tried under Jordan. They tried to tank, and they ended up with the worst, you know, winning percentage for any basketball team ever in that lockout shortened season. They didn't get Anthony Davis, and they decided to go out and get a really great coach in Steve Clifford and try to build with the few draft pieces that did work out in Kemba Walker. And now I think there's a couple of things going on. One, they want to build a sense of continuity. And getting Nick Batum through the trade and build through trades, because they are not going to be a free agent destination. That's just a reality. It's a lot of this is accepting the realities of what's going on in the NBA. You know, you're not going to get an audience with Kevin Durant. You've got to work through the trade market. And Rich Cho, the general manager of the Charlotte Hornets, is a master of working that trade market. So they've done that well, but I think the second reality is that they are trying to rebuild a fan base in Charlotte.
Absolutely.
And you can't do that by losing. You have to, and we say this all the time in the show, the only way to get the casual fan back into the building, back into the Hive, into Time Warner Cable Arena, is by winning playoff series. And I don't think no one's under the illusion that the Hornets are going to win a championship this year, or next season, or even 10 seasons from now. But the casual fan feeds on hope. You want to know that when you go to Time Warner Cable Arena, you're going to watch a team that has an opportunity to win and win in the playoffs. And so once they start doing that, the fans will come back like they did when the Hornets were originally in Charlotte. And so I think knowing that, it informs a lot of what you're seeing the Hornets do and the way that they're deciding to build the franchise at this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually did have the Hornets penciled in for a 2025 championship, but I guess I can erase that really quick. I have a very complex system for calculating those odds. Like,
it's important to keep your eyes on the future.
Yeah. But okay, so that's what I was sort of expecting to hear. And so, you know, with that in mind, right, you do have some really talented young players. You are starting to build a core, you know, certainly around guys like Kemba Walker. I can't wait to see Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. I mean, for all the talk about how beautiful it is to watch Warriors basketball, which, by the way, it is, you know, you don't need to be taking pull-up three-pointers to be really fun to watch. Watching Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is really a pleasure. So, you know, between him, Kemba, and, you know, Batum now, maybe even Marvin as he sort of ages, can be a veteran presence. you are sort of starting to, like you said, build continuity. My question is, okay, Frank Kaminsky, he's, yeah, that's it. That's it. You know, I don't have anything more to say. Like, my question is Frank
Kaminsky. The question is Frank Kaminsky, question mark. Well, I think, listen, you know, we have an owner in Michael Jordan who has say in the basketball operations. How much say is up for debate, and, you know, some would question the his say, and you know, I think it's certainly fair to do that, but he fell in love. Look, the bottom line is he fell in love with Frank Kaminsky, and you know, they placed their bet on him, and my whole thing with the draft is that every draft pick is a crapshoot, save for your number one pick that's a sure thing, like a LeBron James or an Anthony Davis. Really, every draft pick is a crapshoot. And so I really think that if you fall in love with a certain type of player, you should just go for it and don't second guess and trade for, you know, whatever deal that Boston supposedly offered the Hornets, some Godfather deal. You know, you're trading for several more crapshoots. I don't know that there's a great strategy in trading one crapshoot for nine crapshoots. I don't know.
Yeah. I can't turn this podcast into a debate about the finer intricacies of the NBA draft. I can just say that I disagree with you, and hopefully we can just leave it there. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, you know, there's no sense crying over spilt Justice Winslow. So instead of, you know, focusing on perhaps what could have been, do you think that he is going to end up being a center or a power forward? Do you think that the pendulum in the NBA is going to swing the other direction from the small ball four dynamic, and all of a sudden Frank Kaminsky is going to be the prototypical four once again?
No, I think he'll probably stay a stretch four that can hold his own on at the center position. He's put on some weight in the offseason, so we'll see. You know, he wasn't used down low in terms of post moves last season. He was here and there, but they expressed a desire, that being Steve Clifford and Patrick Ewing, to get more post looks for Frank Kaminsky because he's talented down there. He has a feel for the game, and he's got a great basketball IQ, and his quickness, just like Cody Zeller when he first came into the league, you know, Frank Kaminsky's quickness will be his asset when he's going up against other centers, and he has the ability to finish in the post. So that's what I would look for from Frank Kaminsky in year two, is can the coaching staff find ways to get him off the bench and access his ability to shot fake, drive to the rim, and also set him up in the post and let him see what he can finesse into the rim. But, you know, he's going to be a liability on defense, at least in his first couple of years. It'll be interesting because I go back to Cody Zeller. I mean, he started as a four. Now he's moving to the five position, but he won't be a back down center. He's going to be a guy who gets up and down the floor and uses his quickness still to beat other centers on offense. So, you know, I don't see the NBA transitioning anytime soon, and I think the more size you have down low that can also flex out and be a three-point shooter or run up and down the court, I think the better off you're going to be in the long run because it gives you roster flexibility.
Yeah, I think that makes some sense. And I think that for also what the Hornets are trying to achieve as a team, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, roster flexibility, that's not exactly what you want. And what I mean is that you want to be able to put out your lineup versus their best lineup and then just beat them to a pulp. So the death lineup is the death lineup because you don't have to tweak anything. You just put it out there and it slaughters everything. But like we were just discussing, the Hornets are not the Warriors, and, you know, nor are they the 76ers. They're a talented bunch, 1 through 12. And, you know, first and foremost, they have a incredibly underrated head coach. I hear a lot from Celtics fans. In fact, it's almost a cliche. Brad Stevens is our number one asset, right? I'm sure you've heard that too.
Sure.
But, I mean, Steve Clifford is great. Steve Clifford, in my opinion, is the Hornets' number one asset. I was incredibly impressed by how he went toe-to-toe with Eric Spoelstra in the playoffs this year. It was really one of those series where the Heat didn't win because they were the better team. They won because a couple of breaks went the right way. You know, Dwayne Wade famously hit a couple of threes in the face of this purple-shirted douchebag guy, you know.
Right.
And it very easily could have been the Hornets there instead. And that's really significant. So, yeah, I want to hear your input on that. Do you think that Steve Clifford is that good? Because I feel confident about that, that Steve Clifford is, you know, I think that this was the test. Can he do it in the playoffs? And yes, clearly he can. And unless you have a playoffs caliber coach, it's going to be really hard to win a championship or even get to the third round Eastern Conference Finals.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's coached under both Van Gundys. I mean, he's coached under guys that know how to win in the playoffs. So he comes, you know, from that coaching tree or coaching pedigree. But listen, everyone loves that has played for Steve Clifford in Charlotte raves about playing for him because he's straightforward. Because he's honest, and ultimately because Steve Clifford makes them better basketball players. And I think guys in the NBA in this generation are realizing that if I can go play somewhere that makes me a better basketball player, that showcases my particular skill set, then I'm going to get paid.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not all about, oh, I got to go to the Los Angeles market or the New York market and make sure to get my endorsement deal. I think guys like LaMarcus Aldridge and other free agents are looking more towards what can I do to submit my legacy? What can I do to become a better basketball player? And I think that's why Steve Clifford is the perfect fit in Charlotte, because Charlotte, again, as I said before, is not going to woo free agents by showing off the city or by showing off marketing opportunities. They have to convince players that if you come to Charlotte, you're going to showcase your talent better than, you know, other opportunity X. And again, Steve Clifford, his coaching style resonates with a certain type of guy. And we've talked a lot about this during the offseason shows that, you know, you look at the offseason moves that they made last season and now this offseason, and it's clear that this organization brings in a particular kind of guy, a more quiet, subdued personality, but that is dedicated to working hard on both ends of the floor. And I think they're doing that because you have to match, or you don't have to. I mean, ask Sacramento. But you should, if you want to win basketball games, match your personnel with the personality of your coach.
Right.
And I think that Charlotte has definitely done a good job of that. And they've extended Steve Clifford now, and I think they'll be a better basketball organization, again, speaking to continuity, for it.
Sure, definitely. And with that in mind, I think that one of these guys, or perhaps the poster boy for the dynamic that you were just describing, is my man Jeremy Lin. So what I really wanted to see from the Hornets this offseason, and what I'm sure you wanted to see too, is you sit down with the people who I wanted to save, right, from last year, between Courtney Lee, Batum, Marvin Williams, and Jeremy Lin. I wanted, you know, Marvin Williams because that exception with him, so he wasn't, you know, so much of a financial hit.
Sure.
And then Batum, just because he's arguably the best player on the team, arguably, of course.
And he makes everyone else better. I mean, even if you want to argue someone else, he makes everyone else a better basketball player.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's a good way of putting it. And then I wanted to keep Jeremy Lin because I wanted the Hornets to start him at shooting guard. Do you think that was ever a feasible thing in terms of in Jeremy's mind? Because I know just from watching the lineups and looking at the numbers that lineups that had Jeremy Lin and Kemba Walker were really, really good. I think that could have worked.
Yeah, I mean, Kemba is certainly going to miss Jeremy Lin. He's been on the record this offseason for saying that. I don't think that Jeremy Lin starting at shooting guard was ever going to be a viable option, mainly because I think Nick Batum really wants to play the shooting guard position. I think when MKG went down in the preseason last season, it would have hurt the team had the bench not played out of their minds through the first few months of the season. But I think Nick Batum naturally wants to play the shooting guard position and doesn't want to carry the load on defense, doesn't want to guard the best defensive player because it just doesn't suit his particular style of play. And that's why it's good to pair him with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. But the thing with Jeremy Lin, I mean, I would have loved to see Jeremy Lin return to Charlotte, but ultimately Jeremy Lin wanted to go somewhere and be the man. And I respect that. You know, he still feels like he has prime years left, and he wanted to spend those prime years being a number one factor for a team. And, you know, I think he certainly would have enjoyed success off the bench for the Charlotte Hornets, but it's not the same kind of high-profile success that I think he was seeking. And I would have loved to see him back in Charlotte. I think him and Kemba Walker, the more I go back and look at tape, the more I see how well they played off of one another. And I question if Kemba Walker and Ramon Sessions can replicate that or try to at least get close to replicating that. I don't know. That's going to be a big question mark for the Charlotte Hornets this upcoming season. But you have to respect Jeremy Lin for wanting to be the man.
He could have sort of been the man if he had, you know, been given the starting shooting guard role in Charlotte. It's actually good to know that it's your opinion that Batum was interested in playing the shooting guard. That makes a lot of sense to me. That even means that potentially one way I could see the Hornets developing is trying to have their size at the 2 through 4 positions so that you can go a little bit undersized at the center position, say, with a guy like Frank Kaminsky. And as much as I think Cody Zeller is underrated, I think he's underrated because I don't think that anyone outside of Charlotte even knows who he is and considers him to be a viable role player. But, you know, that's the degree to which I think he's underrated. Like, I think he's a very good big off the bench, and that's it. I don't think he should probably be starting. And there's a universe that I see Kaminsky turning into someone who could start. So, I mean, what do you think about this idea of the Hornets in the future going, you know, switch heavy, Kemba Walker, Batum at shooting guard, insert 3 here, maybe Rudy Gay, and then, you know, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist at the 4, and then Kaminsky at the 5, so that you do have all the size at 2, 3, and 4 where you can compensate for some of Kaminsky's shortcomings as a player?
I'll tell you, if Michael Kidd-Gilchrist plays the 4 position, it would be for a very limited minutes, very unique situation. I don't think that Steve Clifford has any interest, or at least he hasn't expressed it, and borderline has said that that's really not an option for MKG to play the 4 for extended minutes. I just don't think that, because they want to play 4 out, possibly 5 out whenever they can. And while MKG's 3-pointer is coming along, I don't think that it's developed enough to put him in any kind of like stretch 4 position. But I think that Cody Zeller is still transitioning into that center position. It seems like he's getting into the weight room and really dedicating himself to transitioning to that center role. And once he did midway through last season, he played a lot better. And him and Nick Batum have found a great pick-and-roll relationship. So I'm interested to see in this next season how that relationship between Nick Batum and Cody Zeller continues to flourish in the pick-and-roll, and how his transition continues to the center position, because he came into the league and the team wanted him to become a stretch 4, and it just didn't develop. And I think it's a bit of a miscast, and I think that's why nobody knows Cody Zeller, is because they've spent, you know, three or four seasons trying to figure out what exactly his skill set will be in the NBA, or what's best for the team and what's best for him. I think they finally figured that out, and we'll see how it develops in year 2 of the Cody Zeller at center experiment.
Right, and that makes some sense. Part of the reason why I asked if there was a reality where you could have enough size at 2 through 4 to have Kaminsky play at the 5 is because, like you said, we've all seen what happens to the Hornets when there's not enough spacing. Lance Stephenson. But, Yeah, and the whole system falls apart. I think that, you know, as good of a coach as Steve Clifford is, he can't personally direct and move the limbs of his players so that they're navigating in choppy waters of defense. It's, you know, for him to be like, okay, go curl off the screen. You are going to set a pick here off ball, and this is going to happen. You need space to do that, and it's hard when you have a whole bunch of people clogged up in the middle. That being said, recently MKG went on Woj's podcast, mm-hmm. and Woj, one of the questions that Woj asked MKG was, do you think that all this spacing, this sort of dynamic that Steve Clifford wants to go with of having all these three-point shooters out on the court, do you think that that is a bad sign for you? Do you think that that might phase you out? And what MKG responded with is, no, that sounds great. It just means that there's more room for me at the basket. So, I mean, MKG is a stupendous athlete. And if he does play the three, he can definitely use his size to finish down low. He's managed to be efficient playing that position despite having, you know, no three-point shot to speak of. And I feel like the more that you can create space around for MKG to just get to the basket and try to put it in, the more you are going to see him start to be the type of player that everyone wanted him to be when he was drafted, sans jump shot, right? If the jump shot comes, that's great. If it doesn't,
it's
starting.
No, it's. I mean, his work with Mark Price was incredible two seasons ago, and it continued to develop when he returned after the All-Star break last season. He was only around for seven games, unfortunately, before he re-injured that shoulder. But he hit three-pointers during that stretch.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And you know, I can see him being a corner three threat, especially early on, because he's not going to draw. You saw it in those seven games. He doesn't draw attention. So he's, I think early on in the season, he could be a three-point threat simply because there's not going to be anyone out there guarding him until he can prove that he can knock down the shot consistently. But yeah, I mean, you know, him getting to the basket is extremely important, and not only in the half court, but he is a threat in transition. It's not, right. The Hornets did not run a lot of transition last season. They're not a high-paced team, but a lot of that I think had to do with the fact that MKG's not on the court. He is the quarterback of the Hornets' transition attack, and we just didn't have that last season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand the pickup of Bellinelli in terms of that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that Bellinelli has a better season for the Hornets and
than he did in Sacramento, sure.
Yeah, I'm split on that. I am wavering back and forth, but we can go to that later. But the reason I went into that whole dissertation trying to explain my thinking about MKG as the guy who finishes at the basket is precisely because of the similarities between Steve Clifford and Stan Van Gundy in terms of their coaching style, and the fact that Steve Clifford is an apple from the Stan Van Gundy tree.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine instead of Drummond or Howard being the role man in a four-out offense, it's MKG, right? He can focus on a pull-up, quick-release eight-footer. You know, don't focus too much on good shooting form or whatever. I mean, if you look at Sean Livingston, he's never developed an outside shot, but his sort of wonky form works really well because at least he has a high release, and he can just sort of not even jump shot it. It's like he jumps and then he just plops it into the basket, something like that. I mean, I just feel like MKG is the explosive type of guy where he's enough of a threat to just slam on someone if he's on the way to the basket, that, you know, if you can't fix that jump shot, he has the weird ball behind his head on his jumper, you know, that weird form that I'm talking about.
Yeah, again, it's improving, but yeah, it's not fully there yet.
I mean, that might be good if you're just trying to get downhill as fast as possible, and if it's, say, Roy Hibbert, which you won't have to deal with, but if it's someone like Roy Hibbert, then you just, like, you know, really quick, stop on a dime, and then shoot that weird sort of behind your head shot, and it's not going to get blocked. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I was thinking, is sort of a modified four out. Instead of having a hyper-athletic center, you have a hyper-athletic Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. That would be fascinating to me.
No,
and I think it could work, too.
I think it could work. I think another, but there's another issue and another big question mark for the Hornets this season, which they could address with a trade, is the depth at the small forward position. There's really not a true small forward behind Michael Kidd-Gilchrist at this time, so there's not a ton of flexibility there to move him around the traditional, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But you know, if they were to address that in a trade, they have a few pieces that they can move, like Spencer Hawes and Jeremy Lamb, whose contracts now look suddenly very inexpensive and movable. Mm-hmm. Then they could do that. But right now, you know, they don't have a lot of size at the three position behind Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. So, and a lot of that would have to depend. Really, I could see that more as an option. Not next season, but the season after that, if Frank Kaminsky continues to put on weight, if he can hold his own, not only defensively, but also on the boards. I mean, he got beat up on the boards.
Yeah.
So he'll have to continue to develop if they want to pull something like that off.
Well, and like we discussed, I think Steve Clifford is a very good lineup manager. He's good at, you know, making little tweaks to make sure that everyone is being utilized in the best way possible. And with that in mind, do you think that I've been thinking, when I look at potential lineups for the Hornets next year, I've been thinking that he might want to tie Kaminsky to Gilchrist so that Gilchrist can make up for that rebounding, can make up for some of that defense, and then Marvin Williams to Cody Zeller.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think Zeller to Batum is also another good pairing, as I mentioned before last season. Zeller's field goal percentage was 54.2% with Batum on the court, and it dropped to 46% when Batum was off the court. So they developed a good pick and roll relationship.
Yeah.
No, I like that. And Steve Clifford is always harping on playing groups, and you know he is mm-hmm. a great, or at least he thinks a lot about the lineups that he throws out there. But yeah, I think he's always going to want to mix. You know, if you got to understand the principles that Clifford espouses, and then if you understand those, then the lineup choices that he makes, you don't have to agree with them, but it certainly makes, I think, a lot of sense. I mean, offensively, they're going to continue to shoot three-pointers. They're a patient offense. It's a low turnover offense. It's a pick and roll and dribble handoff dominated offense. And that's a big reason why Batum is so successful within this offense, because he takes that dribble handoff better than a lot of NBA players. And then defensively, they're not aggressive. They're moderately conservative to conservative. And they don't shot block, because they don't really have a true shot blockers. They acquired Roy Hibbert. We'll see how he integrates into it. I think that'll be a big question mark as well. But they've been.
Do you want to get into that?
Let's do it. No. I think Roy Hibbert's going to be the real X factor in terms of how this defense plays this season, because after they let Bismack Biyombo go, they haven't had a true shot blocker. Marvin Williams had to step up into that role last season, and he did that a lot with help side defense and help side blocking. But they haven't had, and Roy Hibbert does that to an extent as well, but they haven't had a guy who can, you know, one-on-one just physically go up and match body to body and block a shot and since Bismack Biyombo. And now they have one in Roy Hibbert, and the question is, can Roy Hibbert do anything on offense to justify, and I don't mean, I mean just based on past, you know, the past year in Los Angeles. It was not a good year offensively. He put up a lot of goose eggs, and I think you'll have to do a better job offensively to justify having him on the court for defense's sake.
Yeah, how optimistic are you about that?
Well, listen, it's tough, because I'm a little worried, because now for two off-seasons straight, the Hornets have taken this strategy of finding value in players that had down seasons and betting that down season was a result of fit, of style, of place, and not of deteriorating basketball confidence or ability. Right. I mean, they did that with Batum. They did that with Jeremy Lin. and so on and so forth. And now they're doing it again with both Bellinelli and Hibbert. And it's like, how many times can you strike gold? So we'll see. And if you look two off seasons ago, you can see the results when they don't strike gold, because they brought in Brian Roberts, they brought in Jason Maxiel, and they brought in Marvin Williams. And while Marvin Williams had a fantastic season last season, he was nowhere to be found two seasons ago when they first brought him to Charlotte. So you just have to wonder if that bench unit, because Marco Bellinelli and Roy Hibbert, at least for the first part of the season, will be coming off the bench. You have to wonder if that bench unit is going to be able to have the same kind of impact that Jeremy Lin, Jeremy Lamb had for the Hornets last season.
Okay.
So I'm not pessimistic, but I'm not optimistic either.
I'm okay, wink, wink. I think I know what you're saying. Okay, you're not... I'm interpreting that as pessimism is what I'm saying.
It's the same thing as last offseason. There are so many question marks at this point. It's not like, oh, there's one guy that's a question mark and I can make a determination about him based on the other players around him. I mean, they continue to take gambles on guys off of bad years.
Yeah.
And you know, I've examined, talked to Anthony Irwin from Silver Screen and Roll about Hibbert's season last season. And it, you know, he and Hibbert has gone on the NBA show on the Ringer podcast network and said that he was uncomfortable in Los Angeles. He didn't like to be the veteran amongst a lot of young players. It didn't fit him and his.
He's just like you, not a big fan of Snapchat.
He said he's a lone wolf. You know, he likes to just play Xbox and not play. You know, just play with randos.
Yeah,
and so you know, I think that there's already an inset group of leadership within the Hornets locker room. So hopefully Hibbert can be more comfortable in Charlotte than he was in Los Angeles and be more free to be who he is. And because he's coming off the bench, I think that, at least I assume, he'll be able to sort of redefine himself and not feel the pressure that comes along with being in that starting role. And so yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it is hard, I would imagine, for you as a Hornets-specific radio podcast guy, analyst, we'll say, to filter out all the noise that is inevitably going to come when you pick up a player like Roy Hibbert.
You know, that brings up a great point because, and I think that's what really outlines the difference in my feelings towards these acquisitions that the Hornets keep making, is that yes, they are gambles, but they're so low risk.
Yeah,
it makes it hard for me to be upset about them, because you look at Hibbert's deal, it's 1 year, $5 million. So I mean, there's no, if Hibbert doesn't work out, they do have plenty of depth in the, they've got more depth at the center and power forward position than they do at the small forward position. So
yeah.
You know, they've got options if Hibbert continues his downward trend, but it's so low risk. Whereas, well, even bringing in Greg Monroe would be low risk because he's got that player option. You know,
well,
it's just hard to be. Yeah, it's just hard to be upset with that move when, you know, Roy Hibbert is still an accomplished shot blocker. It's been trending downwards, but he has. The past performance to prove that he is a good shot blocker. The Hornets could stand to have a physical presence inside to block shots.
And the pace of the Hornets, or I guess the strategy of the Hornets, where they sort of commit to a half-court offense,
yeah,
and defense,
that matches him.
Right? Not trying to get breaks, making sure that they secure defensive rebounds. That would be a lot more like what he thrived in Indiana.
Well, and they're going to play smart. They're going to play intelligent basketball. It might not be they don't necessarily have the most talent on the court at a given time, but they do play intelligently. And I don't think
you
can
say that Byron Scott is not intelligent.
Listen, you just go back and listen to my podcast if you want to hear some rants on Byron Scott. I won't get into it on this one, but yeah. So, but no, it's a good point because I think Hibbert felt like a lot of times he was left on an island and left out there to fend for himself. And you know, he's a good help defender, but
right,
you know, if if there's only so much a man can do on help defense if the initial attack isn't stopped or at least heated in some way. And so, you know, I think you're going to see Hibbert in a situation that's calm, that allows him, again, he's playing for Steve Clifford, who makes basketball players play their best basketball and play up to their potential. And I think you'll see him thrive in that position.
Yeah, I think that what Roy Hibbert's always been about is he's never been a whack-a-mole style or Anthony Davis style frenetic post defender.
Yeah.
He's not going to contest multiple shots in any given possession. But, you know, when Indiana was consistently the best defense in the league, when it got to the place that, you know, offensive player X somehow managed to get past Paul George, MKG in their circumstance, managed to maneuver around Lance Stephenson, you know, Nicholas Batum in this circumstance, and George Hill, when you did manage to break those line of defense every time Roy Hibbert was there for the final contest in the right spot. But when it's the case that Roy Hibbert is responsible for that and help defense on another guy, then that's when it breaks down, because Roy Hibbert is just not a spectacular athlete unless you're factoring in his 7'3" frame. But, you know, I'm not, for the purposes of this argument.
Yeah.
It's an interesting double-edged sword, because I think that if he wasn't so smart, he wouldn't be so, for lack of a better word, neurotic. But if he also wasn't that smart, then he wouldn't be such a good defender, and he wouldn't be able to compensate for the fact that he's not the most explosive athlete, and he wouldn't be thinking well enough to be like, okay, the way that this play is heading, I'm going to need to be here to contest this shot because that's the most likely outcome. And if he's going to get back to that, where he can consistently predict what his teammates are going to be doing around him on defense, which, I mean, Julius Randle's so bad at defense, you can't predict what's going to happen there. But if he can get back to a place where, like you said, there's intelligent basketball being played, I think he might be able to be a snug fit.
Well,
in
and think about this too, Chris. When he was playing his best basketball in Indiana, he wasn't a great direct rebounder. Like, he wasn't snagging the defensive and offensive boards, but he, because he knew how to take up space and he knew how to block out, he could block out multiple players.
Yeah.
With that big frame, he allowed guys like Paul George to swoop in there, grab an offensive board, and connect for two more. So here's the pairing. We talk about pairing and playing groups that you know, you're excited to see. I'm excited to see if Roy Hibbert can be paired with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist in some kind of reserve rotation, where, because MKG is one of the few players that has a license from Steve Clifford to get offensive boards, because the Hornets don't offensive rebound. They prefer to get back and stop transition. That's what they hang their hat on, stopping easy baskets. That's what part of what helps their defensive rating. But if you can have Michael Kidd-Gilchrist swoop in, and he's good at doing this athletically, and put back offensive rebounds, that could be a serious 1-2 tandem weapon that the Hornets could have in this next season.
Yeah, that's pretty poor spacing, I would think, but...
But listen, I mean, you know, you have to... It wouldn't be something that played, you know, 10-plus minutes a night in the rotation, but in a given situation, we saw... And really, it goes more towards what we saw in the playoffs, where when the Hornets needed to get physical defensively, especially inside against Miami, they couldn't do it. And I think that they've acquired some tools, and if MKG can stay healthy, that's the big if that will get repeated many times on Locked On Hornets. If that can occur, then you've got that ability to do that.
Yeah, I can see that. Going back to something that we touched on a little bit, and I'm a little reticent to do this because we've already talked about it at a somewhat great length. It's such a fascinating possibility to me. The whole Michael Gilchrist-Kaminsky potential pairing, with Gilchrist eventually playing the four position. I know that you said that Steve Clifford is hesitant to do that, and I think at least for the start of the season, while he's coming back from some of his injuries, that, you know, it's probably a good idea to not pair him at the power forward position, and then, you know, Kaminsky at the center also has its own particular problems. I just think that, you know, especially with two guys like Kemba and Batum, say Kaminsky sets an off-ball pick for MKG, the power forward's too slow to recover to a small ball power forward, and he's shorter than Frank Kaminsky, so he switches. It's almost like just from that pick, just from a Frank Kaminsky to MKG pick, you would have two open men because no matter what, whoever's involved in that isn't going to be able to switch in time to cover Kaminsky. So if there's a short guy on Kaminsky, Kaminsky can always shoot over him. And if he does switch, MKG is going to be way too fast, and he's going to be able to just get a pass from really any of these two really good playmakers that they have, Kemba and Batum, and then there's a somewhat open basket there.
Yeah, I just don't know who rebounds on that. I mean, MKG is a good rebounder in terms of flying out of nowhere to grab rebounds, but if you've got anybody, I mean, if you play anyone with size, I just don't know who rebounds on that lineup. That's the only problem. I think that's where you run into issues until Frank Kaminsky can bulk up and become a better rebounder. I think that there's the problem of depth at small forward, and there's the problem of rebounding when you put MKG at the four that I don't think that they can really get around at this point. It's an interesting prize. Here's the thing, and we hear it all the time. We hear, why do you expect to see MKG at four? Do you expect to see MKG at four? And, you know, while it sounds like something that you would do, that makes some sense because we see these, you know, lineup, these death lineups from Golden State. I just don't know. Well, first, there's two things. I don't particularly know if it would work within what the Hornets have currently on their roster and the abilities of that, you know, that interior presence that I just talked about. But also, yeah. I just don't see. I mean, Clifford harps on size. And I just, you know, he wants to play four out, one in. But he also wants size. I just don't see the MKG at the four being a possibility.
Do you think that Batum has such a size advantage on twos, and then Marvin Williams, if he's playing opposite Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, you would have, you know, 6'9", 6'9", 6'9", and then Kaminsky and Kemba.
Yeah, but if you went, now we're getting into semantics, because if you paired Marvin Williams with MKG, Marvin's the four. MKG's
oh yeah, three. Yeah. I mean, if that's so, I guess moving away from the whole lineup thing, we'll put Marvin Williams in the corner, you know, right for a setup play like this. I mean, just sort of pulling away whoever's covering him, that would work better, right? I mean, in that case, if there was a small forward defending Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, then Kaminsky would just be shooting over a small forward instead of a power forward. If anything, that's good.
Yeah, no, I think if Kaminsky bulks up like they say, like he's rumored to have bulked up and he's improved his rebounding and improved the consistency on his three-pointer, you have to remember that too. I mean, he was very streaky.
Yeah.
He'd go months of not shooting the three ball very well and then months of shooting it very well. But listen, there's a reason. I mean, he's going to be in year two, and it took Cody Zeller three or four seasons before he really got his role. It's not even about like learning the NBA. I mean, it's about figuring out exactly what kind of player you want to be. And I don't think we've seen the final evolutionary form of whatever Frank Kaminsky is going to become yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. I suppose you can't just go ahead and assume that Frank Kaminsky is going to be the type of Kelly Olynyk / Dirk type, you know. You know, I hear pump fake and then drive from the 3-point line, and I think 6'11" guy, that's immediately the type of role that I think of. But I mean,
I think he was successful. Excuse me, he was successful at times with that, and you have to remember that he started his basketball playing career, Kaminsky did, as a point guard, so he has that sort of point guard spirit about him. And you know, I don't know if that's what's going to be his calling card ultimately, but he certainly has that in his repertoire.
Yeah. I think that part of the reason why, you have to get into some of the semantics and some of the nitty-gritty things is because that's really what this Hornets lineup is. It's not going to be the type of lineup that you can have real sustained success by using a blunt weapon.
Correct.
You know, it's like you have to be able to capitalize off of little things. Steve Clifford is going to have a lot longer than a 45-minute conversation or an hour conversation about, okay, can we do this? You know, can I use MKG in this particular way? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I mean, MKG is a difficult nut to crack. He, unless he's in a really good situation in a really well-paired lineup, he's going to be an offensive albatross. And at the same time, he's such a good athlete that I don't see why the right lineup couldn't make him an offensive hub, right? Like the key piece, right? That role man that, you know, a Stan Van Gundy / Steve Clifford offense would feasibly have. But, you know, moving on from the X's and O's, because we could talk until both of us die from, I guess, starvation, about the little lineup changes. So Jordan, as an owner, we all know what he is like as a general manager, and that is that he gets fired. And you briefly mentioned that you don't know how much his hands are on the playing card deck, I guess, how much he's influencing decisions. He's certainly doing a good job with marketing, I think, but as far as basketball stuff, it's unclear what his role in all of this is. But I think that we can speculate that he's improving, that he's learning how to be an NBA owner.
Sure.
And I, and the rest of the league, I think, were really critical of him and like, oh God, he's doing it again. Like, frickin' Jordan, like, what are you doing? And recently, you know, whether it's, you know, fair that I've seen the actual improvement, I've just been sort of forcing myself to return to that idea and make sure that that's fair to say, okay, this is what Michael Jordan is and he won't ever evolve or adapt, because, I mean, as a player, he evolved and adapted. I think that he's a man who can adapt, even if he always wears 90s clothing and that weird earring thing. He can, as a person and as an owner and as a player, he did evolve and adapt. So all that is to say, is Michael Jordan a good owner? And if he isn't, do you think that he will be?
I mean, I think that he has brought winning basketball back to Charlotte, and he brought he recognized that the community had an affinity for the Hornets' legacy and did everything that was necessary. Now, I'm sure there were financial motivations, obviously. I mean, this is a business that he's running. But
Republicans, you know, go to Hornets games too.
Right. But he, well, that's a whole nother issue. That whole quote is probably a little misattributed to Jordan, but anyhow, but I think he recognized that. So I think those are two good ownership qualities. And I think lately he has been, again, past couple of years, he has leaned more on Rich Cho and other smart basketball guys to make certain decisions, and extending Clifford was a very good idea, and he's been willing to open up the purse strings reasonably to get players re-signed. You know, I mean, you have to remember, like, you think back to the Hornets ownership of past, before the team left town and went to New Orleans, that ownership group was not always willing to pay what was necessary to keep the talent that the Hornets had homegrown. Not traded for, but just homegrown.
Yeah.
And they were willing to trade very good players to serve economic needs. And to Jordan's credit, that they've been willing to get out there and do what's necessary to bring winning basketball to Charlotte. And I'll add this as well, with everything that's gone on with the All-Star game being moved from Charlotte, he took an active role in trying to keep the All-Star game in Charlotte, but at the same time stand on principle and stand with the NBA on their principles, and you know, took an active role and a public role. And I think, in my mind, that should also be factored in when you're talking about what kind of owner he has represented, I think, what makes Charlotte great in trying to keep the game in Charlotte, but also standing on principle.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the obvious criticism there is, you know, that he's calculated in his, you know, business brain that he can, or maybe even financially should, go out and make some of the statements about gun violence or about the whole LGBT Charlotte problem, Charlotte gets a bad rap because I think Charlotte was the city that was trying to overturn the whole North Carolina thing. So I think that phrasing is a little bit off. The North Carolina LGBT problem. You know, the natural criticism is, oh, well, you know, he would have been doing this before, but now it's just financially in his benefit. And I say, you know, even if that is correct, right, I think that it's a much different question to say, okay, maybe he was holding all this stuff back. But if that's the case, then at least he was thinking all of these things the whole time. You know, if he was reticent for whatever reason, that is sort of, you know, his right as a public figure to not speak out.
Yeah, it's his prerogative. Right. And also, I think that's a very, I would say to anyone who thought that's a very cynical way to look at things. That I, you know, I think you just have to judge, you know, when you're talking about a person, whether it be a business person or not, I think you just have to take the man's actions and the man's words for what they are, and judge it based on that. But I'll also add this on the basket, getting back to the basketball side.
Sure.
We've talked about this a lot on the show too, that whether you agree or disagree with the team building that's going on in Charlotte or the strategy that they're employing to bring good basketball to Charlotte, whether you agree or disagree with it, the Hornets have laid out a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And they've laid out the path that they feel can get Charlotte back to playoff success. And they've instituted it, and they've stuck with it. And if you've been around Charlotte basketball for a long time, you don't take that for granted, because so many times this team, and I'm talking about Bobcats, but I'm also talking about the Charlotte Hornets of old, they would set on a strategy, set on a course, and then halt it and reset, and it would set back the franchise for a few years.
Yeah.
Until they could get back on track, and they would get lucky with a draft pick or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this team is trying to do things in a manner that is unique to their situation, unique to their market, and again, I think whether you agree or disagree with it, they at least have a strategy, which is more than you can say for other franchises operating in the NBA right now.
Are you talking about the Kings?
I'm always talking about the Kings. You listen to the show, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, the Kings are just such an easy target, but that's what makes them so lovable as an easy target.
Right.
So, I guess just, you know, before we sign off, some of the more, not so nitty-gritty questions, the more, generic. How many wins do you think they're going to get? What seed
73.
Do you think? Well, see, I'm surprised that you're that cynical. I mean, I had them at 76, but...
Well, listen, I'm trying to be real. It's called being realistic.
So is that your final answer? 73?
No. Listen, I don't know. That's the whole thing I learned. I'm learning every year that I cover basketball. Answer: I'm 29 years old, so I'm learning along with our listeners. You know, I don't pretend to be, you know, a basketball sage. I'm just trying to take all of this in, and we're all having a discussion together. But what I'm quickly learning is that, you know, November basketball means relatively little in the grand scheme of things, and the final record at the end of the year, unless it's record setting, unless it's 73, really doesn't mean anything other than getting into the playoffs, and you end up playing a completely different brand of basketball. So it's fun. It's fun to watch 82 games of the regular season. But you know, guessing what the record is, I mean, who knows? And I don't think, as long as the team gets into the playoffs, I think that's really the only question that matters.
Okay, well then, sort of rephrasing the question, once they get to the playoffs, are you expecting Eastern Conference Finals or second round or...
Well, I think you got to win that first round game or the first round series. They you know, I think that's the goal, win a playoff series. Do they do it? I think there's so many question marks right now on this bench unit and what's going to happen to Spencer Hawes and Jeremy Lamb. You know, are one or both going to get traded? And if they do, what will the Hornets target? When I think they've got to target something in terms of small forward depth, but I think they also have to go out and get more athleticism. They've got a lot of skill players on this roster right now. We've already talked about Roy Hibbert, a lot of skill, little athleticism. Marco Bellinelli, a lot of skill, little athleticism. Frank Kaminsky is a lot of skill and a little bit of athleticism. So I think they've got to go out and find that, because that's what beat them up in that Miami series, is that Miami just simply had more athletes than Charlotte. So, yeah, my estimation is they certainly have the skill to win a second-round playoff series, but I don't know right now if they have the athletic ability. So we'll see. We'll see. Year two. Year two is exciting because they do have such continuity on that starting five.
Yeah.
Sans MKG. You know, his reintegration, I think, is going to be a big key as well. But they've got so much continuity that I think that it will be interesting to see how they develop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that now, at least, you have in your starting lineup between Kemba Walker, Batum, and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, I mean, three really good, and then MKG, I think, is a spectacular athlete. But, I mean, in terms of depth when it comes to athleticism and in terms of being able to put five good athletes on the floor at any given time, that is a bit of a question mark. And, you know, like I said earlier, we could talk about the Hornets until we both die, but instead of saying that, I'm going to say thanks for listening to Almighty Ball, the Almighty Podcast. You've been listening to our guest today, Doug Branson, host of Locked On Hornets / Hive Talk Live / the pod, the Bobcast?
It was originally the Podcats.
Oh, Podcats. I was close. I got the
close
general
enough.
Idea.
It's dead and gone, unfortunately, so.
Well, okay, so just Hive Talk Live / Locked On Hornets, and Doug, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. Everyone, you should check out our show. If you're listening on iTunes, give it 5 stars, write a review, you know, say something nice about me in the comments too. It helps his show grow and get out there, and it helps me fill the review shaped hole in my heart. And Doug, you know, one more time, just in case people weren't quick enough to take out their pen and pencil and they haven't figured out that you can just rewind podcasts, go ahead, say social media, you know, Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah, follow us on Twitter at Hive Talk Live, on Facebook, facebook.com/ Hive Talk Live. Sign up and subscribe to our YouTube channel where we will be broadcasting our live shows this upcoming season. And check us out on iTunes. Just search Locked On Hornets. We're part of, I just want to mention this real quick because we're excited about this. We're part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Go to audioboom.com and search Locked On and check out if you're, maybe you're not a fan of the Hornets, but you're a fan of another team. You can check out and find out if Locked On has your team podcast and listen along.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been rolling through these, you know, 16, 17 team previews. So I'm hitting on all of them. This is number 18, I think. So we're going at a pretty good clip. So if you're an Almighty Ballin' listener, you've already heard me say to, you know, David Locke, the proprietor, and to Philip, the host of Locked On Magic. And then I think you're number 3. I've said before, just go subscribe to all of them. If you're a big NBA fan, just wait to see, huh, that looks like an interesting topic. Click on it, listen, you know, it's going to be a lot, but if you're listening to this, you love basketball, and I love you for it. So thanks for listening once again. I appreciate it, and I appreciate Doug Branson, host of Hive Talk Live and, you know, Locked On Hornets.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome, man. Hey, that was fun. That was challenging and good, and you know, I love doing stuff like this because it helps us do our thing, get our chops up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I get pretty deep into X's and O's, so it takes a while for me to try to find hosts who I think can keep up with it, you know?
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, I try to listen to one podcast per team, and I listen to you guys and really enjoy it. So yeah, you guys do a great job, and I'm glad I chose someone who was going to, you know, hit those volleys back. You know?
Well, and listen, I had to bring it. I mean, after, you know, I felt like I'm like, what am I doing, man? I'm glad we made this happen, and I thought it was a great conversation. So hopefully your listeners like it.
Yeah. You know, next time we talk about the Hornets, you'll be the first person who I contact.
Hey, man, thank you. Thank you again, and we'll just let me know when it goes up, and we'll pump the hell out of it.
All right, great. Thanks a lot.
All right, talk to you soon.
Bye.